Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Each weekend here on Faith Radio, you have the opportunity to hear Cradle My Heart, which is a wonderful, encouraging program that is hosted by Kim Cotola. Kim is an author, speaker, and a broadcaster, and cares deeply about the life issue and those that have experienced the pain and heartache of abortion. So we want to talk, Kim, just to get a little update, mention the program, encourage people to listen, but welcome, first of all. Good to see you.
Hi, Neil. Great to see you again.
We've seen, obviously, a significant change at the top level of government in this life issue. You know, as we approach another Roe v. Wade anniversary, has been going on for a long time. Is a change at the top, does that potentially make a significant difference in the battle for life?
Well, when people talked about the significance of the Supreme Court appointments, there is a real possibility for change there. It's not foolproof, though, because when Ronald Reagan came into power, he said he would appoint pro-life justices, and he appointed Kennedy and Sandra Day O'Connor, and Kennedy proved to be the swing vote back then, and even most recently on the whole women's health decision in Texas, which the Supreme Court rolled back some very reasonable restrictions that Texas had put on abortion practitioners. So you can appoint someone who says they're pro-life. You're not sure how they're going to vote on any given case. And it depends, you know, what case is before them. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably the most effective strategy. But again, it's not foolproof.
In general, are you encouraged that we hear reports that, you know, younger people are more pro-life than their parents? So is the argument, despite the press, winning the day?
Well, I think that, Neil, the evidence is so overwhelming now that it's much harder for the abortion industry to get away with the deception and manipulation of telling women it's just tissue and it's not a baby, and really leaning on that flawed wisdom of the Roe v. Wade ruling, which said potential life. They use that verbiage, and that's nonsense. It's binary, as my engineer husband says.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're either alive or you aren't. You're either a human being or you aren't. There's no such thing as potential life. We even hear commentators like Megyn Kelly. Every time this issue came up in the election cycle, she used that term. And I don't know if that's her lawyering background, but it's bogus. Because the science of embryology tells us life begins at conception. That is not controversial, Neil. We know there's a new organism, a new life from conception forward. And so it's much harder. And coupled with DNA, 4D ultrasound, everybody has now seen a baby's face in utero, right?
Yeah.
Everybody has seen a heartbeat before you can make out the baby's body at 16 weeks. And new Oxford research, Neil, shows that that heartbeat is at 16 days. Mm. 21 days was the old benchmark. And Oxford has now shown the heart. That means there's a human heart present. How are you going to tell this generation in the face of that evidence that it's not a human being, therefore it's morally acceptable to terminate its life? I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense that the younger generation is rejecting it.
From the science, the biology, irrefutable, but the argument still centers around what? Right, a woman's right. Isn't that the stumbling block, perhaps?
Right. Now, I've been training with Scott Klusendorf to make the case for life for Christian high school and college students. And so that's how we build our case. We work off the syllogism that Francis Beckwith, who is a professor at Baylor, in his book Defending Life, Professor Beckwith came up with a syllogism, and it's real simple and easy to remember. He says, abortion is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. It's wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong, is morally wrong. And so as we make that case, most people will object to that second point, that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. They'll say, well, it's a human being, but it's not a life. It's not yet a person. And they'll really make a logical fallacy. They'll engage in a logical fallacy of not understanding that human beings are not constructed we develop, which means we retain our identity throughout the life cycle. So you're the embryo you once were, Neil. Yeah. I can just picture you back then, you cute little thing. Grandparents, we marvel at this, right? You look at that grandbaby's fingernails, and then you look at your child and you think, wait a minute, those are the same.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. But anyway, so human nature develops. Human nature is what gives us value because we develop and retain and maintain our identity throughout the life cycle. And so it isn't some function. You know, some philosophers will say, well, it's when cognition happens, when the baby can think, or it's sentience, when the baby can feel, or it's when the baby develops a brain stem, which would make them capable of, you know, thought. No.
Yeah.
We have our value by virtue of our human nature. And when you talk about rights, I think this is one of the things that's a real sticking point for most people. They get it, but then we hear a story about a woman who needs abortion. We hear about dire circumstances, or these days we hear unapologetically, I don't need to give you a reason. I have bodily autonomy. It's my body, my choice. But what we have a great opportunity for witnessing and for discipleship right there, because if anybody has rights, it implies there's a rights giver. And rights are granted by the government or by nature or by God. And take any of those three and ask yourself, what right giver that would give rights to one group at the expense of another is any kind of a just rights giver? You know, if you come at it from a social justice point of view, it's clear that the youngest members of the human family deserve our protection.
Kim Cattola is with us today. We're talking about the case for life. Where are men in this process? Are we making any headway there in terms of guys understanding what this choice is really leaving women with, what the kind of scars they're bearing?
Well, I tell guys, young men all the time, don't let anyone back you down because you're a man and you can't have an opinion about this. First of all, Roe v. Wade was decided by 9 men. Okay. Back in the day, there were no women on the Supreme Court, first of all. But more importantly, arguments don't have genders. Right? We're presenting evidence. We're presenting objective facts and evidence. They're either true or they're not. And if someone refutes them, it's up to them to present the proof that they're not true. So, of course, men can have an opinion on this. And when it comes to brass tacks, Lifeway research recently found that the most influential person in a woman's decision to abort is the father. And I've talked with young women, Neil, and this is the lovable irrationality of the female mind, maybe. I don't know how we want to characterize it. But a girl will say, I found out I was pregnant. I was pretty sure that I couldn't have the baby. I didn't want to become a mom. But when I told him, he said, abortion, right? And it crushed me. Even if she hasn't yet formed the idea that she wants to have this baby, become a mother, marry him, all those other things, there's a baseline rejection that women experience if the man says to her, this is something that we should destroy, because it's part of her. And the maternal instinct is real. I mean, I can't back that up with science, but our common sense and our intuition tells us that. And so men are in a double bind, though, because the culture says it's not your decision. It's her choice alone. But, you know, Neil, when I talk to young men, I ask them if it's okay with them how unjust this Roe v. Wade ruling is to them. Because if a man wants to protect the life of his unborn child, the state says he has no legal status, even if he's married to the mother of the baby. There have been at least 8 court cases, and in every case, the courts have told the men, you have no say, and the abortion proceeded. On the other hand, if she wants the baby and he doesn't wish to parent, the state will compel him to pay for 18 years. Wow. These are not equal rights. Yeah. You can talk about women's rights, but these are not equal rights. You've eliminated the child's right to be born, to live, to grow the way nature and God intended, but you've also eliminated the civil rights of men.
Kim Cattullo is my guest today, a sought-after writer and motivational speaker, and the host and executive producer of Cradle My Heart Radio, heard here on Faith Radio each Sunday evening. It's a live interactive outreach featuring leading voices in pro-life and post-abortion ministry. Kim has also written an award-winning book, Cradle My Heart, Finding God's Love After Abortion. We're going to talk more in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. To Connecting Faith. You know, abortion continues to be a hot topic in politics, women's rights, and medical practice, but for the 8 to 10 million American Christian women who have had one, abortion is a spiritual issue as well, raising questions of life and death, heaven and hell, grief and loss. We want to talk more about that in the moments ahead with Kim Cattullo. Kim is the host and the executive producer of Cradle My Heart Radio, heard each Sunday evening here on Faith Radio, and she's also written the award-winning book, Cradle My Heart, Finding God's Love After Abortion. Kim, you mentioned the maternal instincts. I know that much of your work has been centered on those who have experienced the pain, the loss of abortion. This is a real loss, and there are real consequences, aren't there?
Yes. Well, Neil, you know, you can choose abortion, but you cannot choose your consequences. And that's one thing that I think women don't understand. They don't understand that, well, I was ignorant. Maybe some do. I mean, over half of the abortions that happen in America, about a million a year, it's somewhere between one in every four or one in every five pregnancies, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Many of those women are ignorant, but many of them are repeat procedures, and there can be emotional reasons for that, too. But I had a sense that there was a life involved, but I didn't know that it was my child. That was too, it was too devastating to think of it in those terms. And when I made the decision at age 23 to have an abortion to protect my career, when my fiancé said, abortion, right? I mean, he wasn't that cold about it, but basically he did not consider that, okay, we'll just go ahead and get married and have this baby, because we were engaged. But so when that happened, I felt I had no choice. You know, and also now I have a career and this relationship's over. So I'm going to have to take care of myself. I can't be a single parent. It was a long time ago, almost ancient history now. I mean, those things have changed too. A young woman doesn't have to choose between career and children these days, right? Yeah. And there's not as much shame attached to single mothering. It's still a difficult road, but you wouldn't be shunned for it, I hope, by any good Christians. But it was problem solving for me, and problem solving based on an ignorant premise that there's no child involved. It's just a pregnancy. I'm terminating a pregnancy, not a life. But, you know, Neil, those who know my story know that the Holy Spirit interceded. I was not a follower of Christ, but right before the procedure was to take place, the attendant took my hand and asked, are you all right? Because I was very detached. And I looked at her and I thought, I'm not all right. I need to leave. I need to get out of here right now. But I didn't have the strength of character to do that. And so I had to grapple with the reality that I had placed my life in front of the life of a defenseless human being, which is called cowardice. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to deal with that. And I had to deal with the fact that, you know, I was a mother to this child and now this child is no more. Those are huge issues to deal with when you're young and as immature as I was. I was in my 20s. I can't imagine what teens go through trying to sort all of this out. And even lately, having become a grandmother, there's a new season of grief. My mom is deceased, and her life was in adverse circumstances when she found out I was pregnant. But the fact that she didn't strongly act to defend her grandchild has been a new source of grief that I've had to process. And I've forgiven her, and I would never speak against her. But grandmothers play a huge role in these decisions. And she thought she was doing the right thing. She thought she was protecting my reputation, you know, but I've wondered what I would have done had she said, we'll make another place at the table, a baby. But I didn't hear any words like that. And so it's very difficult to deal with the rejection from lack of support that we feel, to deal with the fact that we have to come to terms with the fact that we've harmed another human being to the point of death or participated in it. You know, one thing I do, though, Neil, is I always tell women that you're only accountable for your part in it. There were many, many players in that abortion decision. And I think that's what Jesus was getting at in that encounter with the lame man at the pool. You know, he talked about, there's no one to help me in the water. And then after he got up, he said, you know, who told you to walk? You know, and he said, well, that guy. And he blamed. And Jesus was like, look, some personal accountability is what you need if you're ever going to not be lame. And of course, we know that was a physical affliction. And I wouldn't ever say there's a spiritual root for someone who has a physical disability. You know, I'm not equating it, but I'm saying the dynamic is there. The lesson for the rest of us looking on is there because we are crippled emotionally by our sin. And Jesus said the accountability is the answer, particularly when he is there to say to us, you don't need to blame anymore. I know everything that happened. I have already forgiven you. I've accomplished your redemption on the cross, and follow me. You know, to do that, though, we have to repent and we have to say without excuse, I sinned. I participated in the taking of a life, you know, and it's one of the hardest things you may ever have to do, Neil. And I think part of the reason is because we fear that that's going to end the whole experience of having had this child. You know, because there's no blanket to clutch to, you know, there's nothing tangible to remind us. But I know that child is in heaven. Sure. I know Christ holds that child. And that's my hope, you know. And so we help women to memorialize their children rather than memorializing that pain. Mm-hmm. I know. And we can only do this through the mercy of Christ.
Just the other day, I heard John Stonestreet on Breakpoint talking about and it was a release from Planned Parenthood that was talking about being sensitive to those who had miscarriages because there is, you know, emotional pain involved. He said, isn't it interesting that they will speak of that but not of abortion, which is that they confusion, of course, I guess we can point the holes in the logic of organizations like that all day long, probably.
Well, before Roe v. Wade, in the 1960s, Planned Parenthood, in their materials, told their clientele that it was a baby and that abortion was not acceptable. It's very interesting. Wow. Dr. Mark Newman, who is a pro-life speaker, and he also coaches debate. I'm forgetting the university he's attached to. But anyway, he found one at auction. And there are very few extant copies of it, but it, you know, and they've got illustrations of babies on the on the brochure. Yeah, this is a recent development for them that abortion is morally neutral and that women need it. And they fight very hard against the message that it's detrimental to women, to any women. They, you know, because even when they tout their research that 95% of women feel relief and nothing more, which, okay, if three women go shopping for shoes, Neil, there's not going to be a uniform emotional reaction. there's no monolithic emotional thing among women. But let's take them at their word and look at the 5% who may be damaged. You're talking about, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of women annually if it's a million procedures. You're talking about, you know, levels that would put social, public health issues like autism and other things that we're very aware are problems in people's lives. It pales. Those things would pale in comparison. And they're quite cruel in the way that they attack those who bring the message that some women may be hurt. And it's, to me, it's very nonsensical, you know, because the ground that I've occupied, in the beginning, I would say, you know, my ideology really has shifted as I've learned more through the years. But in the beginning, I was called to tell my testimony of healing after abortion. I was very ignorant about the pro-life movement. I had a stereotype in mind of angry protesters. And really didn't want to be identified with that. But I said then, and I'll say it again now, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers isn't trying to enact prohibition. They're trying to say, okay, this is a legal product and it's dangerous. And some people are really harmed by it. You know, it's not a perfect analogy because there's no safe abortion. But in other words, abortion is legal. Some are hurt by it. I'm offering them help. Why in the world would you object to that? Because it sheds light on the real problems that exist with what they're selling.
Kim, just if in a minute or two, if we've not been engaged in the making the case for life, is there one thing or maybe one step we could take today? What would be effective in getting us on this road?
Well, I think there are a number of things we can do. You asked for one.
Okay.
but Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life, is excellent. And also, I would go to YouTube and look for his debates with Nadine Strossen. Mm-hmm. He just had another one recently this week. They're wonderful representations of the two points of view argued from logic, and how to make the case on either side. And you'll see that Scott wins those arguments, those debates every time. So his book is a wonderful resource. I'm available to come and speak to schools. Okay. I have an underwriting grant. So a Christian school, high school, I know they don't have great budgets. Yeah. You can bring me in to speak and do that training. I think it's really important that we support the pregnancy help movement. I mean, Washington, D.C. is where the laws are made, but abortions are happening in our neighborhoods. You know, we need to be active locally, offering people a real choice, you know, whether it would be to place the child for adoption or to parent. The pregnancy help movement is very effective in doing this, and we all need to know what that local center is so we can make referrals. We need to support them with our dollars and with our time and prayers.
And make a point to listen to Cradle My Heart Radio, heard each Sunday evening on Faith Radio at 8 p.m. Central Time. Kim Cattola has also written the award-winning book, Cradle My Heart, Finding God's Love After Abortion. She speaks regularly and leads counseling and workshop sessions to help individuals recover from the emotional and spiritual wounds of abortion. And Kim, thank you for this important work that you're doing and for your part in the ministry of Faith Radio.
Thank you, Neil. Appreciate it.
Now, coming up in a moment on Connecting Faith, we'll learn about a venture that empowers the church to fund and resource social innovation ideas across local communities as a way of mission outreach. Stay tuned for more on Connecting Faith. To Connecting Faith. And if you're a young entrepreneur and want to make a difference in your community, stay tuned for our conversation ahead. You're going to find out about something called Innovate Studios, about making a difference, maybe a new way of doing missions, about impacting a local community. Innovate is a social venture incubator that empowers the church to fund and resource social innovation ideas in the community. It originated as an outreach idea of Colonial Church of Edina, Minnesota, and we're going to find out about it in the moments ahead. So we talk with Daniel Harrell, who's pastor of Colonial Church, and Brian Jones, who was on staff at Colonial up until just recently, where he is now taking on the role as director of Innovate Studios. And gentlemen, welcome to Connecting Faith. It says on the website that Innovate is all about growing new ideas to serve the world. Say more.
Well, I mean, I think the concept grew out of a passion for trying to figure out a new way to do mission out of the church that would engage the gifts that Workaday folks were using Monday through Friday. We were fortunate to have some funds available through a land sale that we were wanting to give away, but we wanted to do that in a creative fashion that would engage our congregation at deep level. So we came up with this idea for a social entrepreneurial contest with coaching, with various folks in our congregation that would judge and come alongside. So we invited application from all across the cities, people 35 years old and younger with a faith that they wanted to put into action. And we took them under our wing. We picked a few of them. We coached them. We put them through a contest ringer. And at the end of it, picked a few, funded them, and launched them. And it was a process that in our church involved about 150 people start to finish as screeners and what we called navigators, sort of mentors, as skills coaches, as judges, as people that would come along on the backside and get these entrepreneurial ventures set up. And it was particularly attractive to these young folks for whom work and faith and meaning needed to all come together. And to get to be a part of that was pretty special.
When we think of mission, it's probably not what we'd think of, what you've just described. So why do mission this way? And maybe what's unique about this?
I mean, historically, certainly for churches, you know, I've been around long enough to be acquainted with the old divide between, you know, what we used to call social gospel and evangelism. And I think as those things have started to come together more in new generations and people recognize, you know, what James had taught from the beginning, that faith and work has to come together, that the extent that we can use these familiar aspects of our life in the world, business, service, and then invest that with a kind of meaningfulness and purposefulness that the gospel informs, it makes, I think, not only for those doing the work more meaningful, for those who are recipients of what these enterprises are trying to do, more significant. And hopefully, we think as pastors, by bringing together, you know, mission as service and mission as Christians engaged in following Christ, that we can, you know, build in some sustainability that perhaps some mission programs and churches have struggled to maintain.
That's often the case, isn't it? That those parts of the ministry outreach sometimes kind of lose their way or their effectiveness.
Or it becomes too much of just a check writing kind of operation of the church. And we recognize that for mission to be effective out of the church, our people got to be involved, not only in giving and prayer, but with their own hands and passions, and to try to wed ventures that we're involved with the talents that people have, just assures a level and depth of involvement that builds some very strong sustainability and investment relationship in it.
Well, Brian, while we're talking, you have just launched out on your own, I mean, away from the pastoral role at church to now be heading up Innovate Studio. So that's maybe a little unnerving, but kind of exciting.
This is the very first week, so it's odd for me right now. I still consider myself very much a pastor at Colonial Church. But.
Sure. Well, give us a sense of maybe just by way of introducing us to what are some of the examples of the projects, the things that you funded, got started, and what are we really talking about?
Yeah, so many of these were just ideas of someone who's like, here's a problem, and wouldn't it be great if we could do something to solve it? And the results were things that we never would have thought up on our own. A few of the examples, one is Exodus Lending. And this young social entrepreneur, she was like, payday loans are really trapping people in this cycle of debt. Wouldn't it be great if we could do something about it? And so Exodus Lending came from that. Beyond Limits is another one, and that serves young adults with special needs. And they thought, well, you know, the problem is, what are those students going to do after high school? What are they going to do for the rest of their lives? Can they get independence from their parents? And the result of that was Beyond Limits, which creates a college experience for these young adults with special needs. And so those are some of the first round ones. Some of the second round Innovate projects, we got a little more confidence, I think. And so we tried to stretch it even a little further. And so one of them is Hoyo. And Hoyo is the Somali word for mother. And so this is a benefit corporation, so a for-profit, and the mission is to employ single Somali moms making Somali food, so to provide employment, but the mission is to help nurture those Somali moms. So some really neat projects.
So is there a distinctive other than, I mean, if we were looking at a, you know, community service group that was working, you know, in metropolitan areas or even in rural areas, I mean, how would this be different from, you know, one of those groups?
I mean, this has honestly been a challenge, I think, as we thought about this as church. What is it that's distinctively Christian about this? And on the one hand, I think we've said, all right, have some of these categories that we have insisted upon historically, do those need to be investigated in a way that would, you know, allow for some coming together in faith and life in ways that may have been restrictive before? But on the other hand, we recognize that for all of these young social entrepreneurs, you know, it is their faith in Jesus that motivates them to address these genuine problems. And we trust that in the context of that work they do, that, you know, their faith authentically finds its way to show. And I think we live in a culture that's much more suspicious of Christianity than perhaps it used to be. And so this need to earn a right to be heard often happens when we see people, faithful Christians, involved in, you know, legitimate enterprise to serve the common good.
Any reason why 35 and under? I mean, why that age range?
Yeah. Well, Daniel mentioned it before, just talking about, you know, Colonial has long had a heart for mission. And so Innovate was a sense, well, can we merge that with a head for mission? And so it was this intentional means to get the business experience, that Monday through Friday experience of the folks in our congregation and to engage their Sunday faith. And so our church is a white collar church, a lot of boomer age people with tons of experience and just a real heart for mission. And so the idea was, who is the underserved people that could benefit from that experience? And that was the under 35. And so we matched that millennial energy with the boomer experience, and the result was these projects launching successfully.
Which I guess probably ties in with the mentorship, right? This coming alongside, that's really an integral part of this, isn't it?
It's been key. I mean, I think part of what, you know, every church in this day and age seeks to do is to engage that intergenerational power and strength that's so much a part of churches historically. And this allowed us to do it along a track that was a little, you know, non-traditional by saying, you know, here's somebody with a passion, with an idea, but how do I make this thing fly? And to have people with some genuine life and business experience to help them was fantastic. And the joy the mentors got out of coming alongside these folks in their church was pretty special.
You know, Jesus calls us to serve. Obviously, that's being demonstrated. Give us a sense of what it's done for the people that have been involved. You said, you know, some maybe 30, 40, 50, maybe 100 people involved in some of these things. How has it impacted and changed them? Maybe just as a pastor, what's it done for your congregation?
Well, in addition to being able to use these gifts that are a part of your identity, often occupationally and otherwise, I think that, you know, having been involved in the process, then opened up an invitation to people to be involved in the projects themselves. So we have any number of folks who volunteer, serve on boards, continue to coach and come alongside these young social entrepreneurs with advice and encouragement and prayer. And I mean, all those things just continue going on and on. And, you know, because they've been able to develop a good relationship, even with those projects that are international, not just local, there's, you know, an advocacy that continues not only within the context of the church, but, you know, in other places where access and financial need or other things are required. So it's, I think it's just been so rewarding for our people to be able to use what they're good at, you know, for the sake of the kingdom. And oftentimes, you know, they've got a chance to meet new people and collaborate and do that together too. Yeah. So it's been great.
Brian, you were in business in law enforcement actually before becoming a pastor. Oftentimes, you know, the ministry is not really connected with the day-to-day work world. Has this helped maybe you even as a pastoral team to say, you know, how are we really utilizing the men and women that we have in our congregation that have some skills, some gifts to offer?
Yeah, I think that was what was fun for Daniel and I. One of the main things is, as pastors, you really you know,
you don't know anything about business,
which is a qualification, I think.
Right, right, yeah.
And then the business lives of your congregation. Yeah. And so we really got to know like what they do in a day to day. And it helped us to get to know the congregation a lot better. And now I can say that I know them on a Sunday, but I know them on a Monday through Friday as well.
Are there strings attached for those innovations that win? I mean, I guess if you want to replicate this in other situations, talk about the outcomes.
Well, I think most pastors are surprised that none of the projects or the entrepreneurs of these projects attend our church or are involved with our church. This all ended up being projects outside of our congregation. But in each case, I think that opportunity for a relationship was invited and in many instances taken up on. And so I think it's given us a broader perspective of what it means to be a part of the kingdom of God. Because, you know, what we've done in several cases just simply given a jump start to some of these organizations that have become much bigger and much more effective than anything we could have done. But they couldn't perhaps have gotten that next step without us. And so we're very proud, you know, in a lot of ways to have been able to play that small role.
Yeah. All right. So if people want to find out a little bit more, you know, what do you recommend? What's somebody maybe has an idea or they say, hey, I'd like to bring this to my church leadership team and how can we partner? Yeah. Where can we go?
InnovateProject.org is the website and there's a contact information and that will soon be replaced by InnovateStudios.org, which is the mission to see if this is replicable in other churches.
Right.
The same way of thinking about missions, if other churches could do something similar.
Which would be amazing to see, right? That would be another multiplication of this and really maybe re-energize churches in their missions committee, certainly.
It's not for every church, but I think for churches that, you know, we're passionate about this kind of work and have a congregation to support it, it's very rewarding.
Growing new ideas to serve the world. We've been talking about Innovate Projects, and you can find out more online at InnovateProjects.org. That's I-N-N-O-V-E Projects.org, InnovateProjects.org. Brian Jones is the new director of the Innovate Studio, Innovate Projects. He has been on pastoral staff at Colonial Church in Edina. Daniel Harrell, also with us today, is pastor at the Colonial Church, giving us an update on this new opportunity to serve the world, InnovateProjects.org. Well, you're listening to Connecting Faith, and coming up in a moment, we'll talk to Pastor Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He makes his visit every other Wednesday, and we'll talk about gratitude and about Christmas and more. It's all coming up just ahead. Well, it's time to check in again with Leith Anderson. Leith is president of the National Association of Evangelicals, longtime pastor, and we always appreciate the opportunity to connect, talk about issues of the day and about faith in the church as well. And Leith, just to start, just want to say happy post-Thanksgiving Day greetings and Merry Christmas. Good to talk with you again.
The season is changing. Good Thanksgiving, and we're excited about Christmas coming.
You know, Thanksgiving, of course, passed, but we should have an attitude of gratitude, I guess, all year long. I don't know if that's maybe harder to do sometimes, some seasons than others, but is there anything that you do maybe or just in terms of cultivating an attitude of gratitude all year long?
There are things that I do. I have a daily prayer list. Actually, I print out a new list and change it every month, but it starts with God every day. So I start my prayer every day with worship and thanks and love and commitment and trust. But that means that every day I have a written notice to me to thank God. And something else that has been helpful to me, at least, is when I think I'm kind of overwhelmed and not very grateful, as somebody who writes a journal, I go back and I read stuff in the past that totally stressed me out, and I see how God provided and what an amazing difference it made. And then I hope we all do this. Look for opportunities to say thanks to other people. You know, send them an email, say something. Write a longhand note. Most people don't get longhand notes of thanks anymore. And it just those types of things bring gratitude into our lives as not a holiday, but an integrated part of our faith and friendships.
Mm.
You know, I guess in light of the latest National Association of Evangelicals leadership survey, obviously we have to be thankful for the free expression of religion and faith in light of the, as the survey focused on, the expected increase in persecution. Obviously not maybe like many in the world face, but how do we prepare for what may be more restrictions and challenges and opposition in the days ahead without becoming alarmist?
We shouldn't become alarmist because that means we're really not trusting God. We need to be convinced that he is completely in charge. Yeah, we do a monthly survey of evangelical leaders, and the one that we just did asked the question, have you experienced persecution, and then do you expect to? And 68% said they've never experienced persecution, but 76% said they expect to. And I want to insert here that among the 25 or 30% that said they had, many of them had lived overseas. So these are evangelical leaders, many of them in missions organizations. And so they hadn't so much experienced it here, but somewhere else. And they distinguished between discrimination, which isn't pleasant, but persecution, which is real hostility that comes from others. Yeah, how do we prepare for that? Well, you know, I think a lot of it is how you choose your friends and your social media and your radio stations and your websites, and to do that wisely, because we're all influenced by those who are around us. And we need to be influenced by those who see the hand of God in everything and everywhere, and who look for the gospel opportunity. Just today I was reading Philippians chapter 1, and there the Apostle Paul is in prison. And he writes to the Philippians and says, what happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. That's quite a perspective. I mean, he really was persecuted. So do we want persecution? We don't, but we trust God in it.
Leif Ted here, and you know, taking that a step further, I'm just thinking about these believers worldwide. We hear more and more news stories about increasing persecution that's happening to them. How can we as believers be effectively praying for them that are really under intense persecution around the world?
That's not easy. We've got to start with being knowledgeable. So the current issue of Christianity Today talks about Pakistan. And because of persecution and discrimination against Christians, they often can't go to school. So only 10% of the Christians in Pakistan are literate. So the way they can learn is through radio and television. And the government of Pakistan just shut down 11 Christian television stations. Well, and that's a tangible form of persecution, but that's something specific that we can pray about. So we need to be knowledgeable in praying for them, and we need to be specific, and we need to hang in there. You know, I don't know about you, but for me, I'm prone to pray when I first hear about something, but give it a week or a month or certainly a year, and I've moved on to something else. But people that are persecuted overseas, they haven't moved on, and we need to stick with them in our prayers.
Now, speaking of moving on, be interested in your thoughts about, you know, in light of the election and the, you know, the people that feel disenfranchised and maybe even afraid as a result of the, you know, the president-elect. And we've talked about, seems to be kind of the two extremes. There's the mocking option or the coddling option. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, here we are in this still divided country, and it seems like we're not doing much to build unity.
So we're still talking about the election.
Apparently so, yes.
Yeah, I guess people are. It's interesting to me that a number of people have started on the next election, on the next time they're going to elect a governor or a senator. It's sort of become all the time, everywhere. Well, I always keep coming back to, we need to, in politics, get our convictions from the Bible. Start with the Bible and not with social media, not with television. And if we have our convictions rooted in the Bible, and one of the tests of that is, would this conviction work someplace where they didn't know anything about today's politics in America? And then to add to that, that we treat other people with love and respect, no matter what they say or do. We need to remember, Jesus, he forgave those who crucified him while they were crucifying him. So how we treat people that disagree with it, how we treat enemies, that is what shows that we are followers of Jesus. And then convictions and treating other people right and trust God, because as Christians, we're convinced that he's not surprised by anything or anybody, and that our greatest opportunities for faith, they often come in circumstances that we would not normally choose.
Another way we can strengthen our faith is to turn our attention to this season. It's the Advent season now, and some traditions put that more at the forefront of their focus during this time. But I know that I grew up celebrating Advent in my Lutheran tradition. Neil, was that something?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't something that we engaged in at all. So, is that something, Leith? Did you? Was that something that maybe as a pastor you made it an important part of the getting ready for Christmas celebration?
Yeah, Neil, certainly you grew up knowing about Christmas, right?
I did. Yes, I did know about Christmas, yes.
Okay, you can stay.
Okay. Okay, I'm just wondering exactly where in rural America you grew up. I think we need to sort of check this out and recognize that Christmas is just powerfully cultural in America. Hey, even people who don't believe in Jesus, they still have presents and cards and music and parties. And it's so cultural that non-Christians celebrate Christmas. Although I think what they often do is they take Jesus out and they replace him with Santa Claus. And to be sure, I mean, I really like the music and the presents and the cards and the parties. But as a Christian, I try to take Santa Claus out and keep Jesus in. So how to do that? Well, in Advent services in church is a major part of it, and encouraging the church to celebrate and acknowledge Advent from Thanksgiving until Christmas. But I think there are things we can do personally. You know, read and reread the Christmas story. In our family, before we open presents, before we do anything, we all sit together. I read the Christmas story, and I pray. After we open our presents, we have a Christmas dinner. And Christmas dinner always includes a birthday cake for Jesus because it's his birthday. And then, I don't know, I think we should ask other Christians, what do you do to get ready for Christmas? That will sort of get their attention. We may learn from them, but we may influence them that they have better preparation for the celebration of the coming of Jesus.
You know, asking others what they do for Christmas, is that a good way to maybe invite others kind of just winsomely to a Christmas service? I mean, we still hear that, you know, there's the people that come maybe at Christmas and Easter come because they got an invitation.
Well, that's true. And Christmas is, in most parts of the country, the most likely time when someone will say yes to an invitation to church, and especially Christmas Eve services. So people are more inclined to come to a Christmas Eve service than anything else. What I have done and encourage people to do is say, well, what are your plans for Christmas? And then say, well, my plans include we're going to have a dinner and we're going to have presents, but we're also going to go to a Christmas Eve service. Are you? And, hey, you want to come along? And I think especially those who might otherwise be alone, so families away or maybe someone who's recently been widowed or gone through a divorce or some other change of circumstance. At other times of the year, it may seem kind of intrusive to people that they're being invited to your church. But at Christmas time, that's far less the case. And Christmas Eve, there's sort of a built-in receptivity and opportunity to say yes. And by the way, the reason churches grow, the reason people reach people, it's a lot of things, but it is especially because the people in the church invite other people to come.
A simple thing to do that has eternal significance and impact. So, Leith, a good reminder for us today. And again, Merry Christmas to you. Always good to talk with you. Blessings on the week ahead.
And Merry Christmas. And blessings on you and everybody.
Thanks, Leith.
Well, Ted, that's our program for today. I want to just remind you, tomorrow we're going to have a great conversation with Stephen Bauman, president of World Relief. December 1st is World AIDS Day, and it's a day to advocate for strategies to reduce the spread of HIV/AIDS, and World Relief has been in the forefront of that for many years, and so we'll get an update on that tomorrow on Connecting Faith.
You'll also have a word about the Christians in Syria that are being persecuted and suffering.
Talking with Leith about the persecuted church. We'll get updates on how we can pray and help those believers in places like Syria. Hey, if you missed part of today's show, I want to encourage you to check out our show page. Go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. You can find the interviews posted there and links to other great shows. So it's myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith.